This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Corporations and big polluters like Norfolk Southern, they don't fear government's ability to regulate them because of the regulatory capture at the EPA.
Investigative journalist Greg Schwartz on the lawsuit against the Tetra Tech Corporation for falsifying test results and retaliating against whistleblowers during the cleanup of radioactive waste at San Francisco's Treasure Island and Hunter's Point Naval Shipyard.
People need to know. They were acting like they released this information, Al-Qaeda could do something with it. And then the EPA releases what the major chemicals are, but not all of them. And then it turned out, I think there were three more very dangerous chemicals that they didn't initially tell anybody about.
Hugh Sawyer, a railroad engineer on the Norfolk Southern Railway, on the catastrophic train wreck in East Palestine, Ohio.
The earthquake on February 6th hit Turkey at one of the lowest points in its neoliberal capitalist path. The government was not ready, didn't care, and had no idea how to respond to the expected disaster.
Mehmet Bayram on the devastation caused by the earthquake in Turkey.
He felt the need to explain to people how the Panther Party came to be in London. And he wanted to show people that Black power was not a slogan, but it was a concept rooted in the fundamentals of African resistance.
And we hear from writer and activist Obi Egbuna Jr. on his late father's writings on Marxism and Black power. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Cleaning up the toxins released in Norfolk Southern Rail Company's catastrophic train wreck in East Palestine, Ohio, will cost tens of millions of dollars. Tetra Tech, one of the companies hired to do the cleanup, is being sued for falsifying records of its cleanup in San Francisco's Treasure Island and Hunter's Point Naval Shipyard. Tetra Tech and Norfolk Southern are both partially owned by BlackRock Investment Management, so BlackRock may break even or even profit on the disaster. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke to investigative journalist Greg Schwartz on the lawsuit against Tetra Tech.
Joining us today is Greg Schwartz. As an award-winning reporter, and he was featured by the Society of Environmental Journalists. He has also done extensive coverage of Tetra Tech and the relationship of Tetra Tech to what has been going on at Hunter's Point and Treasure Island in San Francisco. Greg, why don't you talk about your original work in Ohio and what you found out about the EPA and its oversight of environmental problems in Ohio?
I guess that goes back to my time. As I know in today's story, that's out at Counterpunch, and I was looking for something to investigate. And so I sent an email to Bob Petrakis from the Columbus Free Press, who was a reporter whose work I admired. And I asked him if he might have any tips on something I might investigate in Northeast Ohio. And he put me in touch with an activist named Chris Borello from Concerned Citizens of Lake Township, which is near Canton, Ohio. And reporters were already calling her the Erin Brockovich of Ohio when I met her in 2005 for her devoted activism to investigating what was really there at the Industrial Excess Landfill Superfund site in Uniontown, Ohio, which is just north of Canton. And so I worked with her for more than a year on that story, actually, and learned a lot from her about digging into crooked science and regulatory capture in the EPA Superfund program and at Ohio EPA. And I eventually got that story published as a cover story with the Cleveland Free Times called Buried Secrets. And every now and then she would call me up and she'd say, you know, we'd catch up, and then she'd say, Greg, I know you're gonna come back to this story someday, the IEL. And I'd always say, I don't know, Chris, I feel like we took it as far as we could. I don't know where else I would go with that story. And that went on actually for more than a decade until one day in 2018, when she dug up a 20-year-old press release from the Project on Government Oversight in DC that was questioning why the EPA was rehiring a contractor at the Industrial Excess Landfill named as PRC/Tetra Tech, when that contractor had already been found to have made numerous mistakes in radiation sampling testing procedures there with the groundwater at the IEL. And me and I'm reading it, and the list of mistakes, it just, a light bulb went on in my head, because the stuff they were describing was similar to what whistleblowers had reported about Tetra Tech EC at Hunter's Point. And one of those items was even exactly the same, as I note in today's story, the mistakes on chain of custody forms that would bring into question the validity of those forms. And so I thought to myself, wow, I didn't know who Tetra Tech was back in 2006, much less that they had any involvement or that there was anything to suspect about them. Being back in the Bay Area since 2016, that story was big in the news. So I was familiar with it. And I think maybe it took someone with an Ohio, San Francisco connection like myself to connect these dots. When they were being called PRC/Tetra Tech, that was because they had acquired a contractor named PRC, Planning Research Corporation, Environmental Management, which Tetra Tech apparently purchased in 1995. Technically after the water sampling controversies from 1992-93 that Pogo was calling out in that press release in 98. But by the end of 98, PRC had been renamed Tetra Tech EM. And Tetra Tech EM also did participate in a controversial groundwater sampling at the IEL in the fall of 1998. And then they were controversially tasked by EPA with putting together the community involvement plan at the IEL in 2001, which Pogo again objected to. So, Tetra Tech Incorporated likes to claim that they had nothing to do with what went on there at the IEL, but that's not really true. Their subsidiary, Tetra Tech EM, was involved both before and after they bought them. And so it's kind of an inconvenient truth, I think. They don't like me to point this out, but, because they say the fraud by Tetra Tech EC at Hunter's Point was merely due to a couple of rogue employees acting on their own. That's their story. They're sticking to it. The Department of Justice, as you know, of course, has joined those whistleblower false claims lawsuits against Tetra Tech EC. That is still ongoing litigation.
So we have a situation where two executives, managers of Tetra Tech, went to prison federal prison because of falsifying the test results in Hunters Point Treasure Island, which is a radioactive nuclear dump site. This company, Tetra Tech, now has been hired to do air samples. I see a survey that they did, and apparently the air is safe, completely safe in East Palestine. Are you comfortable that that they can be trusted to protect the people of East Palestine and that community?
No, not really. And it's not just Tetra Tech. Of course, the EPA says they have 16 contractors working out there now. But yeah, that was a red flag to me when I saw that Tetra Tech Incorporated was preparing the air monitoring reports there. And maybe they are using the best available science. I'm sure we all hope that they are. But I think the EPA, if they want citizens to trust the science, as Michael Reagan said, I think they should be releasing all of the field work plans that all of their contractors are using for air monitoring, for water sampling, for soil testing. Let's be 100% transparent so that other independent scientific experts can see what they're doing. Because as Steve Donziger noted, he called for President Biden to put together an independent task force to look at this whole issue in East Palestine, because as he wrote, corporations and big polluters like Norfolk Southern, they don't fear government's ability to regulate them because of the regulatory capture at the EPA.
Found a connection between Norfolk Southern and Tetra Tech?
Thanks to Twitter, found someone commenting saying that Norfolk Southern and Tetra Tech both have the same top two shareholders, which I looked into, turns out to be true. Vanguard Group and BlackRock both are the top two shareholders of both Norfolk Southern and of Tetra Tech Incorporated. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Because as I wrote here in the story, I think this encourages a company like Norfolk Southern to take more risks with safety, because if they're taking a financial hit on an accident like this, their biggest investors are basically making it back on Tetra Tech, banking on being involved in the testing and the cleanup. I think we're not sure if they're going to be involved in the cleanup yet, but I think we definitely want to keep an eye out for to see who is going to be involved there.
That was investigative journalist Greg Schwartz on the lawsuit against the Tetra Tech Corporation for falsifying test results and retaliating against whistleblowers during the cleanup of radioactive waste at San Francisco's Treasure Island and Hunters Point Naval Shipyard. BlackRock is a partial owner of both Norfolk Southern and Tetra Tech.
I've been thinking about how to talk about green. I've been thinking about how to talk about green. I've been wondering if I could sing about the green. Trying to find a way to talk about green. Green is a poison rising in this land. The soul of the people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus, seeking out everyone. Greed never stops, its work is never ever done. A creeping, choking, killing, invading everywhere. There is really no escaping.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock, Greed. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ian Garrison. Hugh Sawyer is a railroad engineer on the Norfolk Southern Railway. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer about why the toxic environmental disaster was bound to happen as the company cut back on workers to inspect their railroad cars, and why the railroad industry should be nationalized.
I'm talking with Hugh Sawyer, who is a railroad worker and is also with the Railroad Workers United. Welcome to our show.
Good to be with you.
So you have some experience with working on the railroad and this accident that took place, which has now threatened a community and shown that there's serious systemic problems in the railroads. Were you surprised by this catastrophe in East Palestine?
Not at all. And I should say that I have... These derailments happen all the time. They're not this bad and in a populated place. But we have derailments somewhere in the railroad industry, I promise you, on a daily basis. So it doesn't surprise me. And I have read the preliminary report from the NTSB, which I just put out this morning. And it just seems like one of those perfect storms, if you will, where things go wrong. As I read the report, there were two wayside detectors prior to the one in East Palestine. And, you know, they picked up that a wheel bearing was warming up. And two detectors, I don't know how many miles that would have been, 30 or 40 miles away. Then the next detector, it's up, but it hasn't met the thresholds. And the NTSB report tells you what the thresholds are when that detector is supposed to go off and notify the crew. But so I'm just guessing that this bearing, while it was trending toward failure, didn't meet a threshold until it went past the last detector 20 miles prior to getting to East Palestine. And then that bearing just happened to quickly deteriorate, you know, at a point thereafter. And by the time it got picked up by the next detector 20 miles away, you know, the engineer was already in dynamic braking, because probably that tells me he's going down a hill or slowing up for a curve. And he just increases his dynamic braking. You know, the detector goes off, says you have a critical alarm. And so he starts the process of stopping, but it's too late. The bearing fails. A wheel falls off or whatever, you know, the axle fails and you have the derailment. Unfortunately, those detectors were spaced at just the right point in time for that bearing to go from trending to critical to failure, you know, within that 20-mile period.
And the issue of technology, the railroads have argued, the CEO said that they spent billions on technology. The railroads have promised that this technology would make it so that you didn't have to have conductors, you didn't have to have workers on the railroad. Do you think that this is clear evidence that, in fact, that argument is completely false?
Yeah, absolutely. And human beings or technology is not going to trump the presence of humans. And I think something else that needs to be investigated is FRA oversight. FRA is a failure, in my opinion. That's with 35 years experience. Their safety function, that they've always been kind of under the thumb of the carriers. You need to have a separate safety auditor that is not answerable to the industry. And by that, I mean where that the industry can't influence the outcome of what they find. These guys, they have not been doing their job, particularly over the last 2 years. And it's come to my attention that the wayside detectors, which replace human beings, you know, we had a flight, you know, we used to have cabooses, shorter trains. They looked ahead at the cars. We on the head end looked back, constantly monitoring for smoke or any signs of any kind of a failure. We've gotten rid of all those people. We've replaced them with these detectors. And the FRA apparently has no oversight over these detectors. They haven't governed how they're used. They have no maintenance schedule for them. And therefore, the railroads just do whatever they want to. And we're going to have, all of us are going to have to investigate what's going on. But they've been turning off detectors, I understand, on certain parts of the rails across the country. I was just talking to a guy that operates over UP territory. He said, they don't even say, when I go over a detector right now, it will tell me, hey, axle such and such, alarm, you know, it says alarm, you have a hot wheel, which is not, you know, typically is a sticking brake on axle such and such. Or it'll tell me no defects if it detects no defects. So apparently they've cut off these things out west. They don't even say no defect. And but they're sending messages downtown to human beings downtown. They're looking at the information, and then they're relaying that to another human being, the dispatcher, who then is supposed to relay that information to me, where you used to just have the detector tell me directly what's wrong. You know, hey, we think there's a problem. Here's where we think it's at. And they've detuned them. Now, where I work out of Atlanta, this happened to me just the other day. I went over to the detector. It said no defect, which alerts me that it's operating and looking. And then I get a call that from the wayside detector desk, you know, because it's they're monitoring it. And they say, hey, you've got a wheel that's trending hot. Now, I just went over the detector that said no defect, but you're telling me I got a problem. And they told me to range with the dispatcher to stop somewhere and, you know, go look at that car. Well, I just stopped right there. I was in what I felt was a good place to do it. And I told my brand new conductor to go back there and told him what to look for and what have you. And sure enough, he found a hot bearing, a leaking grease seal, which is the beginning of the end for a bearing. And then we set that car out.
This kind of catastrophe, where's the government? Was the government there? OSHA?
You tell me. That's the million-dollar question. Whatever fault Norfolk Southern has, it's astounding to me at how incompetent the response has been and uncoordinated from the federal government. I mean, the EPA didn't release for, what, 2 or 3 days what was on that train? Let me go ahead and tell you, that crew, and if you read the preliminary report, they were able to cut off. They saw that they had to run. They reported all this, reported the cars were on fire. They decoupled the engines from the train and moved a mile away down the road. And they had the manifest. And, you know, they would have given that manifest to the typically the fire chief. You know, he's the one in charge of hazmat responses typically. And so that and I saw the first press conference, and they admitted, you know, the mayor said, we know what's on this train. We're not going to tell you, but we do know what's on this train. And that's because the train crew would have gotten that consist, the manifest, which delineates exactly where the hazardous material cars are within that train, what's in them. And we have UN numbers and things we can look up. They have a separate emergency response book, and it tells you, okay, you got this chemical. Here's what you need. Here's how far you need to evacuate people. Here's what the dangers are and all that kind of thing. And it tells you what to do for each of those hazardous material cars.
The community, not only did they not tell the press, but the people in the community were unaware of the great dangers of these toxins.
That's exactly right. And I couldn't believe sitting there, the mayor and then the fire chief and the police, they wouldn't tell anybody what was on the train. So, well, we don't know which cars are on fire. Who gives a damn? What cars are in this train? Because you know you've got compromised cars, whether they're on fire or not. You had a bunch of turned over cars, and people need to know. And they were acting like Al-Qaeda. You know, they released this information, Al-Qaeda could do something with it. And then the EPA releases what the major chemicals are, but not all of them. And then it turned out that I think there were three more very dangerous chemicals that they didn't initially tell anybody about.
Do you think the EPA itself is engaged in a cover-up for the company? Why would they?
No, I just think they're incompetent. They've been completely compromised under the Trump administration. You know, they gutted the EPA. I think funding and all that. I don't think it's deliberate. I think it's just incompetence. I'm in a commercial enterprise. You know, the railroads are for-profit corporations. They don't want to spend the money. This is a classic example why you might want to consider public ownership of the railroads and have them run it's a national security interest to have a functioning railroad system that's moving all of the freight safely. But it's not in the interest of these for-profit corporations to necessarily, you know, meet the national security requirements of the country. Keep in mind, you have food shortages on day one of a railroad strike. That's why they don't ever allow them.
And, of course, Trump came to visit the East Palestine.
Oh, yes. God bless him and thank him from bottom of my heart for getting those McDonald's hamburgers out to the people and how generous and loving of him. But he's responsible to a large extent for this derailment happening because a lot of these rules and regulations were thrown out the window under his regime. So,
and the rail unions now are saying that they want reforms. Is there any effort by the AFL-CIO, all the rail unions, to get together and say we need systemic changes in an organized way?
Well, that's where Railroad Workers United comes in. We're trying to get everybody on board. You know, we actually had a bargaining coalition this last go around with 12 of the 13 rail unions, which was remarkable, except that when the Presidential Emergency Board recommendations came up, they all went their own way. They should have remained in a bargaining coalition. So I'll be honest with you, in a perfect world, rail workers would be in one union because there's so few of us left. It's ridiculous to have these different craft unions, in my opinion.
That was Hugh Sawyer, a railroad engineer with Norfolk Southern and a member of Railroad Workers United, speaking with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. The Ballad for Harry Bridges was written by the legendary West Coast Longshore Union leader, Harry Bridges, whom the FBI and the government tried to deport 5 times to Australia. Last week, his granddaughter, Marie Schell, performed it with musician Tony Marcus at ILWU Local 34.
Was his name, an honest union leader who the bosses tried to frame. He left home in Australia to sail the seas around. He sailed across the ocean to land in Frisco Town. There was only a company union, the bosses had their way. A worker had to stand in line for a lousy dollar a day. When up spoke Harry Bridges, us workers gotta get wise. Our wives and kids will starve to death if we don't get organized. Oh, the FBI is worried, the bosses, they are scared. They can't deport 6 million men, they know. And we're not gonna let them send Harry o'er the sea. We'll fight for Harry Bridges and build the CIO. They built a big bonfire around the Matson lines that night. They threw their Fink books in it and they said, we're gonna fight. We've got to get a living wage organized. to the bosses, but the bosses wouldn't talk. They said there's only one way left.
That was the Ballad for Harry Bridges, sung by Marie Schell. On February 6th, a devastating earthquake wiped out entire cities in Turkey. There are still thousands of bodies under the rubble. Despite collecting an earthquake tax for years, the Turkish government was not prepared. Relief organizations had been privatized, gutted, and looted by the neoliberal system, and the Turkish government froze when faced with the disaster. In response to the government's failures, citizens from around the country collected food, water, and medicine for the quake-hit region. However, taking this as a threat to its credibility in approaching elections, the government confiscated the supplies, stopped those trying to help, and unplugged social media. Mehmet Bayram reports.
The earthquake on February 6 hit Turkey at one of the lowest points in its neoliberal capitalist path. The level of corruption, bribery, exploitation, privatization, and outright looting of the people was already taking a toll on this bankrupt country. The government was not ready, didn't care, and had no idea how to respond to the expected disaster. After the last earthquake disaster in 1999, it imposed an earthquake tax, where huge amounts of cash had been collected to prepare for the coming disaster. However, there wasn't a single penny in the treasury. This money had simply evaporated. Turkey, following the neoliberal and the so-called comparative advantage fairy tale of imperialist dictum, had sold off its wealth to foreign and local capitalists at a huge loss. The only comparative advantage it deployed was construction and tourism. The construction industry, supported by and in turn supporting the dictatorial regime of Islamist Erdogan, took off with around 500,000 construction contractors registering for business. In the entire continent of Europe, there are only 37,000 construction companies. These contractors were given free rein. Just as the free market economy desires to build with impunity, regardless of any rules, laws, or inspections to speak of. The government looked away as they stole from the concrete, sand, and iron that was necessary to build safe buildings. Instead of state inspections, private corporations, owned by the very same building corporations they would inspect, sprung up and gave the go-ahead for suspicious and shoddy work. For this favor, the building, inspection, and contracting corporations threw their full support to the free market government. Even those buildings that posed an imminent danger of collapsing survived inspection by several building forgiveness laws by the Erdogan regime and were allowed to be used and rented. The semi-independent search and rescue organization was put on a stewardship program and looted by the government. The Red Crescent and AFAD, the organizations that had done remarkable jobs previously, were gutted, their assets transferred to foundations owned by the president's family members. $8 million worth of Red Crescent's value was simply given away, gifted to a religious childcare facility controlled by the government and run by a close relative of the president. About 40 boys had been sexually abused in the hands of the religious managers at this facility. The same money also ended up building a skyscraper in Manhattan, New York, run by Erdogan's close family and relatives. The government, relief agencies, the military, and the rescue organizations were totally AWOL in the crucial first few days after the earthquake. While people protested and swore at the officials, the rescue effort was directed to the collapsed bank offices to dig up the cases of money, with the police securing and protecting the bank branch rubble. The government, finally understanding the gravity of having more than 100,000 dead on their hand, stepped in, but not in the relief effort. In order to impose a police regime to control the damage, the government declared an emergency situation. The government censor bureau started raining a handful of progressive opposition television stations with heavy fines and closures. Twitter was shut down as the government tried to control the spread of news and the truth from the region. Many survivors trapped under the rubble were using social media to ask for help and giving their addresses from their phones until they ran out of charge. The government's shutting down social media effectively stopped their communication with the outside world. The progressives, socialists, and communists showed a heroic struggle to get to the region, help and organize the relief efforts. Communist doctors, nurses, and helpers flocked to the region and opened up makeshift hospitals, provided potable water, distributed food and water, and set up heaters in the freezing temperatures even before the government help appeared. The government published a decree that it would confiscate any and all supplies sent to the victims. Truckloads of supplies were confiscated, and Erdogan's picture and the government logo were stamped on the trucks and the supplies before they ended up in the earthquake cities, towns, and villages. 10 communist volunteers distributing supplies were arrested and charged first with stealing supplies. Later, the charges were changed to making the Turkish state look weak. The top government officials emphasized time and again that the government was keeping a secret book of those who were criticizing the government, and they would have a price to pay. As days went by, the threats escalated, and finally Erdogan on national TV started swearing at the people begging for help. They were unappreciative, dishonest, lowly scumbags, he said. Now it is the 20th day after the disaster. There are still many villages waiting to see even the first relief workers. While mass graves of unidentified bodies are being buried in pits, while even the water or toilet crisis has not been resolved, government agents are confiscating and selling the tents sent by foreign governments, and the police are arresting those who organize press conferences. While family members and relatives are waiting for their loved ones to be dug up, the government is working on the business of construction, rebuilding, and new projects for development. That is, the transfer of billions to the government-friendly gangster construction corporations that are responsible for the current destruction, but using the disaster as an excuse this time. While people still wait for food, water, tents, heaters, and sanitary supplies, the government announced with glee that if one adopts an orphan child, one could marry them under a religious marriage. The collapse we see in Turkey is not due to the earthquake. It is the collapse of religious neoliberalism, capitalism, profiteering, corruption, and fascism. This is Mehmet Bayram reporting for COVID Race and Democracy.
Elim kolum kelepçeli, elim kolum kelepçeli, oy babu oy oy. Koltuk yumuşak ağa deli, vay babu vay, vay babu vay. İnsan ol da ilme eğil, insan gibi her şeyi bil. Rezil olan şehir değil, köy babu köy köy. Cehalet aklım uçurdu, cehalet aklım uçurdu. Beni yerlere geçirdi, oy oy.
That was Oy Babo by Mazuni Sarif. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Obi Benue Egbuna was a political activist known for leading the Universal Colored People's Association and a member of the British Black Panther movement during the years he lived in England. He published several books on Marxism and Black Power, including Destroy This Temple, The Voice of Black Power in Britain, published in 1971, and The ABC of Black Power Thought, published in 1973. Attorney Nkeshi Taifa, host of the Human Rights and Justice Show on Pacifica's WPFW, spoke to journalist and activist Obiagbuna Jr. about the recent republication of one of his father's books.
What we're going to be dealing with today, Obiagbuna Jr. is the son of Obi Benu Egbuna, born in 1938, a Nigerian-born novelist, playwright, political activist known for leading the Universal Colored People's Association and being a member of the British Black Panther Movement from 1968 to 1972, during the time he lived in London. And the elder Egbuna published several texts on Marxist Black Power, including Destroy This Temple, The Voice of Black Power in Britain. And that was came out in 1971. And the ABC of Black Power Thought, which came out in 1973. And the elder Egbuna's last novel, The Madness of Didi, was published in 1980. And his papers are held at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. So Obi Egbuna Jr., tell us a little bit about the book, Destroy This Temple. I know it's been noted as the first full-scale exposition of Black Power thought in a British context. Tell us just a little bit more about that before we get into the my actual questions I have for you.
Okay, well, thank you. It's an honor to be here as always. But before we begin, because you were using the calendar, on Friday is the ninth year since my father made his transition to the ancestors. He made his transition to the ancestors on the 20th, the same year that Amilcar Cabral was assassinated. So he would be happy about that. And he happens to be born on July 18th, the same day Madiba Nelson Mandela was born.
Wow.
So he came into the world alongside someone who many consider personify the African spirit. And he left numerically on the day with someone who, without question, not only embraces the African fighting spirit, but takes a revolutionary approach to the African fighting spirit, Amilcar Cabral, who you mentioned. The book was the first effort to lay out and contextualize the struggle to advance Black power and the Black Panther Party in Britain. For those who have accepted the same way that colonial language was imposed on us through naked white terrorism, the same way that the seven colonial languages were imposed on us, religious and spiritual systems were imposed on us, narratives by the enemy about our own experience are imposed on us every day. So he wanted to lay out exactly what they did through labor and through service. And he was, by the time that book came out, he was no stranger to writing. Because one of the things my father did is he made some significant contributions to the struggle to make our cultural and political expression synonymous, which many people consider the most difficult aspect of our struggle, because you don't want to have revolutionary culture and reactionary political expression, or vice versa. And many people don't pass that test at all. So he wanted to do that. So in the beginning of 1964, his first book is called Wind Versus Polygamy. And 2 years later, it was transcribed into a play, and it was Britain's submission to the first World and Arts Festival in Dakar, Senegal. So that's the first book.
The original. What's the title of the book again?
Wind Versus Polygamy.
Polygamy?
Yes.
So okay, by the, I can wear it.
Yeah, wind versus polygamy. Okay. And then he also, by the time Destroy This Temple comes out, he had written a pamphlet for Panaf Books, which is responsible for maintaining all of Osage for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah's publications. He did an essay called The Murder of Nigeria, which was the first condemnation of the Igbo-Biafran War, which, if people don't know, in the late 1960s, the same people, sister and brother, cousin and cousin, uncle, aunt, father, son, mother, daughter, started fighting each other in Nigeria, and it left 1 million people dead. So he felt compelled and obligated to write about that. The first person to see the manuscript of that was none other than Shirley Graham Du Bois. Wow. She fell in love with it, and she showed it to Osage for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. And he was invited to spend some time with Osage for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah in Conakry, Guinea, which by that time he was in Guinea as the co-president, where he spent the last 6 years of his life. So he felt the need to explain to people how the Panther Party came to be in London and how Black power was the complement the whole time. And he wanted to show people that Black power was not a slogan, but it was a concept rooted in the fundamentals of African resistance, nationalism, Pan-Africanism, scientific socialism. So that's what he wanted to accomplish with that book. And so it is to the struggle in Britain, it is to the struggle in Europe, what Black power, the politics of liberation, penned by Kwame Ture and Charles Hamilton, were to the movement inside North American borders.
Mm-hmm. So Obi Egbuna Jr., can you just highlight for us the process in relationship to having this epic book be published? And I say epic book, and it's an epic book that a lot of folks don't know about, which is why I'm really glad that you took the initiative to bring it out again. So tell us about that process.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because it gives me a chance to not only celebrate my father, but to celebrate and salute my mother. My mother was the one, when my father passed on, that told me about some extended conversations they had. My father was in the at Howard University Hospital the last 57 days of his life. And so they had extensive conversations about his writing. My mom, being an educator, wanted to put out his literary work first, republished The Madness of Beauty, republished The Emperor of the Sea, republished The Minister's Daughter, republished Daughters of the Sun. For those who don't know, my father, along with Ngugi wa Thiong'o, Chinua Achebe, and Wole Soyinka, played a very pivotal role in popularizing African literature on the continent, right at the same time that the Black arts movement peaked in this country, which we know was an extension of the Harlem Renaissance. So she wanted that work to come out first. So through our lawyer, our good sister and comrade, Mary Cox, she had contacted Paul Coates, our beautiful brother, the iconic, the honorable Paul Coates. As he said, he's glad we introduced him that way at our press conference when we launched the book, and he needs to get used to that, but he deserves that. Because what Paul Coates has done with Black Classic Press is an extension of the work of Dr. Carter G. Woodson, who started the first all-African publishing company 99 years ago, Associated Publishers, in 1924. So what they're doing to Black Classic Press, in our humble opinion, is an extension of that. So Mr. Coates at the time, having the busy schedule they had, the busy roster that they had, he looked at those books, all the books with a cultural and artistic meaning, and he said at this time he couldn't take that on. So, you know, mothers don't listen to their sons. So I was in Zimbabwe and I got back in after being in the air for 26 hours. And my mother said, I talked to Paul Coates and he's not going to publish the books. I said, you asked him about the literary books, didn't you? And she said, yeah. Did I do something wrong? I said, I'm going to show you why mothers should listen to sons. So I called Brother Paul up, told him who I was. I'd never met him up to that point. I just knew him by reputation. And he told me how sweet my mom was, how wonderful she was. And unfortunately, he said he'd get back to us, though, because there wasn't interest there. I said, she told you about the wrong book.
The wrong book.
She said, what? He said, what? I said, what she meant to tell you about was the book he wrote that captures the struggle to build and maintain the Black Panther Party and the Black Power Movement in Britain, him being a co-founder of both. Mm-hmm. And he said, what? Now, this is a Friday evening, and I'm used to flying to Africa, so I wasn't jet lagged, but I was tired. And he said, can you meet me for coffee tomorrow morning? Mm-hmm. So he was so eager that he was willing to meet me on a Saturday at 10 in the morning. It was a thunderstorm that morning, and we spent about 3 hours together. And he said that he would publish the book. So it took 7 years to do it. Cool. Another part of the process is a consistent conversation that my dad and I, that started in 1990, 33 years ago, when I had made a decision that I was going to give my life to the people, give my life to the struggle. He said that it was important not to use his service as a backdrop. He said because it wouldn't, not that he thought I'd do it, but it wouldn't help anyway, because most people in the United States only had quality exposure to our struggle within North American borders. So anything after that, they would consider a footnote. So he said, you're going to have to make your own way. And ultimately, I want people to accept you for what you contribute to struggle. So this is what he tells me in 1990. So around 2010, immigration, imperialist immigration and naturalization services, colonialist immigration and natural services contacted him. And they said, are you the one writing these favorable articles about Zimbabwe and that dictator Mugabe? And he said, no. And they said, it's you, it's your name. Tell the truth. And he said, no, it's my son. Mm-hmm. And so I went to see him and my mom, and he said, yeah, it's time for you to start saying Junior. So it was a complete reversal of our initial conversation. Wow. And then about a month and a half ago, I went to say goodbye to a comrade of mine and a comrade of my father's as well, the great Pan-Africanist of Azania, representative Jerry Shishibe, at his funeral.
Oh yes, Jerry.
And I remember Nana's husband. Yeah. And I remember about 10 years ago, I saw Jerry, and he said, you know, we must never underestimate the power of Japan. That writing that your father is doing about Mugabe in Zimbabwe is breathtaking, is beautiful. Please pass that message to him and say he has the ultimate blessing for me, the ultimate praise. I said, comrade, I can't do that. And he said, why not? I said, he ain't write that. He said, but it says his name. Who wrote it? I said, I wrote that. And he said, you. And I said, yeah. Then he said, started talking about how the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. Yes, so Mr. Coates challenged me to write the introduction for the book. So I had that wasn't even in my thoughts. It was just to get it out and reintroduce it. So he challenged me to write that intro. So it took me back to a lot of valuable memories, going back to my early years, my teenage years, my high school years, and my initial service to the people. So that was the process. So it took 7 years to do. About a year and a half ago, I had started working on that intro. And after four drafts of it, and a blessing from the editor of Black Classic Press, our good sister, Camille Anderson.
Oh, yes. I remember Camille.
Yeah, the intro. Yeah, so the intro got her blessing. From there, what people will see. So you'll get a chance to see the book, and reading the book, the original book, is much more important than my intro. So, but you get a chance.
What a story. And it even reminds me, the Honorable Dr. Julius Garvey, I just published his father, the Honorable Marcus Garvey's book, Philosophy and Opinions with a New Introduction. This is Nikechi Taifa, host of Human Rights and Justice, WPFW Pacifica Radio. And our guest is none other than Obi Igbuna Jr., the son of the great legendary icon, author, writer, revolutionary, Obi Igbuna. And we're talking about the republication of his father's book, Destroy This Temple, which was written in 1971. So you were just following along in that tradition, and we appreciate that. But let me go into a couple of more questions, because I want to get as much in as I can. Can you, you yourself, as you know, I said in the introduction, you've been an organizer for over 30 years here in the U.S. How do you feel a book about the Black Panthers and Black power emanating from Britain will resonate with U.S.-born Africans?
Once they'll get a chance, number one, to learn the true history of the Panther Party, because for people who know the history, the person who really spread the Panther Party worldwide, his full impact has never really been acknowledged. And there's a section in the book where my father talks about Kwame Ture's visit to London for the Dialectics of Liberation Conference. And my father introduced him that night. And a young Angela Davis was in the audience, amongst many others. And in the book, he says Stokely's visit was like a manna from the heavens. Uh-huh. And if you listen to the Africans in India, when they talk about the Panther Party, they say Brother Kwame was the inspiration. When you hear the Africans in Australia talk about, they're gravitating to that concept. They say the same thing. So, and then we know in the United States, people have a tendency to start the Panthers in Oakland, California, not New York City, which was before Oakland, and not Lowndes County.
Lowndes County, Alabama.
Which was Panther Party number one. Mm-hmm. And thanks to a brother named Mark Comfort, who many mm-hmm. people don't mention, who mm-hmm. introduced Brother Huey and introduced Brother Bobby to the concept and introduced them to the history behind the Lowndes County Freedom Organization. So mm-hmm. my father loved Kwame Ture. Kwame used to call him his big brother. And he would be happy if this book played a catalyst in making sure that Kwame gets his just due, for not only in his capacity as the honorary prime minister, setting up 45 branches in North America, but mm-hmm. spreading it to Australia, spreading it to India, and spreading it to London. And not only that, when we first started working with AZAPO, the Black Consciousness Movement of Azania, they mm-hmm. were saying that the concept of Black consciousness as developed by Steve Biko, they said that that should never be separated from Black power. And mm-hmm. when I got to Zimbabwe and I started working with the Southern African Development Publication Series, which are the people who have developed the archives of all the liberation movements in Southern Africa, I read a book that they had over there that said that the Rhodesian government banned the book Black Power and banned any information about Black power and the Black Panther, because the mm-hmm. the armed struggles in Zimbabwe and Namibia began in 1966. So I think that this coming out right now is going to expand people's horizons. And not only that, it will give people a chance to gravitate to the issues that we would consider Panther tradition. So that will be more work around defending the Cuban Revolution and fighting to get the blockade on Cuba lifted. Mm-hmm. It will be more of us will rally and make an emphatic demand that the $2 million bounty on Sister Assata Shakur's head be lifted and she be taken off the U.S. terrorist list. It will demand that the sanctions on Zimbabwe be lifted. Mm-hmm. And so all of these different issues that are considered staples of Panther tradition and staple, and also conceptually, justice, and this is no disrespect to people who have sacrificed their blood, their sweat, and their lives for us to have justice. But we know, those of us who are fighters, we know that justice is an appetizer. Power is the entree. And we are entitled to power, and that's what we're going to continue to fight for. And also the concept of party building. You mentioned Amilcar Cabral earlier. This mm-hmm. gives us a chance to reintroduce the struggle to build the Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. Last year was the 50th anniversary of the death of Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. So mm-hmm. to give people a chance to learn about the struggle to build the Convention People's Party. Last year was the 100th birthday of Sekou Touré, the mm-hmm. first political party built during the anti-colonial movement in Africa was the Democratic Party of Guinea in 1946. And that's why the Mass Emphasis Children's History and Theater Company did the play Ready for the Revolution, which was the battle cry of the Guinean Revolution. Mm-hmm. It'll take us back to 1908, when the Africans in Cuba started the first all-African political party in the Western Hemisphere, Partido Independiente de Cuba. So what this will do is it will serve as a catalyst to make us appreciate party building, appreciate mm-hmm. striving for power, but fighting for power. And most important, and equally as important, I hear many icons in the struggle celebrated, and when people express their love for them, they say he or she spoke truth to power. Mm-hmm. In the spirit of evolution, we must go from speaking truth to power to speaking the truth about power so we can fight for power.
That was journalist, activist, and playwright Obi Agbuna Jr. in conversation with attorney Nkechi Taifa, host of Human Rights and Justice Radio on Pacifica's WPFW. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the CRD Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.